rabbi, any minister sees a great deal of death. And a rabbi is often asked about the hereafter, about immortality. But strangely, it is not so much the dying who ask these questions. There is a surprising naturalness to dying. There is a mist of oblivion which clouds our last hours as our first were similarly clouded. The dead, the dying, seem not so much to worry about the darkness ahead as about the well-being of those whom they are about to leave behind. Death comes without pain. Death comes as easily to man as sleep. And it is the part of wisdom and the teaching of philosophy and of religion to learn to accept the naturalness of death. I have always admired a legend which is told of the philosopher Socrates. Socrates, as you remember, was condemned by the Council of Athens as being an atheist, as a disturber of the peace, and he was sentenced to drink of the cup of hemlock. When the messenger came from the court to Socrates' cell and announced to him that the 30 tyrants of Athens had condemned him to death, history tells us that Socrates looked up from his book and said no more than this: "Well, nature has condemned them. Indeed, nature has condemned each and every one of us to die. And it is the better part of wisdom for us to learn the futility of railing against this fate. The very hour of our birth represents one less hour we have to live." It is hard, I know, to accept philosophically and stoically the death of those near to us or our own impending departure. We all know of those who cannot accept their fate. We all know of those who are troubled by frightened premonitions, who live lives governed by compulsive, superstitious practices in an attempt to blot out from their minds any consciousness, any realization of the fact of death. But of course, this is futility, this is folly. We cannot do so. As with all our other limitations, we must learn emotionally and rationally to live with them and to accept them and not to allow them to contort and to distort the few days of life allotted to us. All philosophy teaches us to accept the fact of death. And yet we are weak and we are human, and our emotions sometimes cloud our reason. We respect such a story as that told in our Bible of King David. King David had a son, a dear and precious boy. And one day this son became ill, seriously and critically ill. David was beside himself, distraught. He paced up and down the palace corridors. He would not eat. He would not leave his lonely vigil. He wept. He wept and he prayed. He refused food. He refused sleep. For 7 days, the boy lingered, fighting for his life. And each day, the father became more tense, more worried. Finally, the boy died. And the palace attendants were so much afraid of telling the king for fear of his anger or for fear of his nervous reaction that they decided that they would not do so. But David sensed that the boy was dead, and he asked for verification, and it was given him. And then happened a change of personality, of emotions, for which the palace attendants were not prepared. For David, instead of exploding, relieving himself somehow of his grief and of his tension, seemed to have all the worry drained from his face. For the first time in a week, he went into his chamber and changed his garments. For the first time in a week, he sat down to a full meal, and then he went to the temple and prayed. The courtiers were amazed. "How, David," they said, "how can you act thus? While the boy was led yet alive, you wept and you fasted and you prayed and you worried. But now that he is dead, grief seems to have vanished from you. Worry seems to have departed." And David's answer is the answer of the reasonable man, an answer which we, unfortunately, in our own moments of grief, cannot always give. For David's answer was this: "While the boy was yet alive, I worried true. I wanted everything that could be done to save him to be done. I wanted to be sure that every precaution for his safety was taken. I wanted to add and to double and to redouble my prayers to God, for perhaps he will be gracious and forgive me and forgive my son and allow him to live. But the boy died. My prayers were not answered. What more can I do? I cannot bring him back to life. All that can happen now is that in time I will go to him." There is true stoic philosophy here. There is true religious faith. And I suspect that David was able to maintain this self-discipline, this emotional restraint, because he was a man of deep understanding and of profound faith. "I have always found it true that those who have taken life the most seriously are those who accept the fact of death the most naturally and the most easily. It is the man who has throughout his life sought to deepen his spiritual understanding who in his own personal life, when confronted by death, is most able to cope with it reasonably." Now, there are some men who want to deny death. There are some men who refuse to think of it as though it is something apart from their lives. They talk of it through euphemisms. When it happens to someone close to them, they find a joking way of dealing with the subject of death. Anything to blot it from their minds, to erase it from their consciousness. It is these men who are most bowled over when death strikes close at home, for they are unprepared for it. It has a terroring strangeness to them. Far better would it have been had they observed it and accepted the fact of their inevitable death and of the death of those close to them, and come to some understanding of this strange phenomena, death. Then I think they would have noticed its naturalness. Then I think they would have seen that even the weakest man who has ever lived has been able to bear the fact of death. Then they would have seen, I think, that just as we did not suffer in the endless age before we were born, so there is no reason to feel that we will suffer in the endless age after we pass on. To consider death is to strip death of its strangeness, is to render it more familiar to us. And the more familiar it becomes, the easier it will be for us to deal with it when it really happens. It is similar reasoning which leads me to feel that many of us do a disservice to our children when we try to hide death from them. It is a common practice today to answer the questions of our children about death with evasion and with circumlocution. We try to hide its harsh reality from them because we think that in so doing we are sparing them bad dreams and nightmares. But I would put to you that we are really only pricking their imaginations, and their imaginations can construct more terrible fantasies based on the inadequate information that we have given them than truth can ever be. I feel that if a young person has learned to cope with death, to understand it and to feel its naturalness, as a young person and as an adult, he will be better able to deal with it. Death is a subject of fear and of fright only when it is subject to us, which we are totally unfamiliar with, totally different from our daily existence. It is a subject which we learn not to fear, but to accept when it has brought into our homes, when it is necessary, when it is dealt with openly and without evasion, when it is a subject of explanation, full and honest. Now, we have spoken so far of death. What then of the life after death. Here we enter a world of pure conjecture. No man has ever made a round-trip voyage into this other world and brought us back a full and adequate description of its geography or of its people or of the type of life that is led there. There are no maps. There are no charts. There are no books, guidebooks, to teach us what lies beyond the bourne of time. There is no empirical evidence to lead us to believe in an afterlife. And I think that modern man has come to the point where he must reject the shadowy evidence of the semi, the half world of the medium and of the spirit voice and of the hypnotic recall. But as there is no evidence, no empirical proof for the existence of a life after death, similarly, there is no empirical disproof for this belief. There is no reason to categorically deny the possibility of such a life. Indeed, it is one of the strange facts of human culture that almost all men have died in the firm belief that they will be born again. Yale University has in the last few years built up what they call a cross-cultural index. It is a file into which the social anthropologist, the historian of religion, the general historian has poured all the facts which he has gleaned about all the cultures of man which have ever existed on the face of the earth, existed, that is, in a form that could be studied. And one of the constants which appear in this culture, in this cross-cultural index, is a belief in some hereafter, in some life after death. Indeed, it is one of the strange phenomena that though we would expect those who believe in this afterlife to have to prove their belief, it is generally quite to the contrary. It is the doubter, it is the disbeliever who is called upon time and again to prove his disbelief. It is as if the world had of one accord felt that a belief in some other life was self-evident and certainly sound. The Bushmen of Central Africa have an interesting legend which is in a way quite typical of the many stories by which men express their firm and unshakable belief in some afterlife and raise the question of how a few cynics in each generation could doubt such a belief. These Bushmen worship the moon. The moon, they say, created all life. It is the moon that brings light into the jungle night. It is the moon which to them brings the coolness of the jungle night and relieves them of the terrible tropical heat. The moon created in the far distant past the first man, the first villages of men. And after the moon had created man, she decided that she ought to reveal to man the good news that there is a life after death, that death need not be feared. And so she commissioned one from her court, the tortoise, to take this message to the villages of men. And she instructed the tortoise carefully in what he was to say. He was to tell man that there was death, but there was rebirth. And the tortoise set out on his way. But the moon began to worry. Perhaps, she felt, perhaps the first man will die before the tortoise, slowest of animals, of course, before the tortoise succeeds in coming with the good tidings to the village. She worried, and she finally decided to send the hare, the fastest of animals, with a similar message. The hare would come first to the village. The hare would see to it that men knew that they need not fear death before the first man died. So she commissioned the hare and sent him as her messenger. But as in Aesop's Greece, so apparently in the Africa of the Bushman, the hare is considered a swift animal, but a volatile one, one not to be trusted as a messenger. And someplace along its speedy course, the hare was distracted from its mission. A beautiful vegetable patch came into being, and she fell too upon this wonderful feast with gusto and delight. And somehow in her revel, she got the message mixed up. And so, though she came to the village first, And though she came to the village before the first man had died, she told man not that the death, that there was death and there was birth, but that there was death and there was no rebirth. And though that same afternoon, later that day, the tortoise came to the village bearing the true message, the seed of doubt had been sown. And though the reasonable man, the shaman, the witch doctor, the village leader, the bushmen know that the message of the tortoise is the true one, nevertheless, doubt had been sown in the minds of a few. And we can understand, the bushmen say, how these few can doubt. Now today, of course, we ask the reverse question. We ask not the doubter so much to justify his position. He may merely say, well, there is no proof to believe in an afterlife. Why then should I believe in it? But we ask the believer to justify his view. And we cannot dismiss his view with impatience, because there is sound observation and reasoning and good philosophy in it. The view of the believer in an afterlife is based upon a reasoned observation of the nature of this world. Great philosophers have thought of this life and have reasoned from it to a belief in the afterlife. They see life as something more than meaningless chance and energy. They see in this life beauty, magnificent beauty. They see in this life order, the order which is shown in the smallest atom, the order which is shown in the vastness of the spheres. They see in this life what seems to be purpose. All life conspires to help its fellow living creature. There seems to be not one single link in the chain of life which is unnecessary. All work for the common good. They look at life, and they see that in life there is no futility. Even death has some meaning. The crop dies so that a new crop can be born. Animals pass on so that there will be sufficient food for a new generation. Man passes on so that there is room for his sons and his heirs, and so that there are jobs which he can fill and positions which he can fulfill and purpose which he can fulfill. Matter is not destroyed, but put to some new use. Life does not pass on without leaving its impact and its imprint among men. And all this has led men to believe that there is some power behind this purpose, that it all could not have been compounded by mere chance, that there is a God, a power which has so created the world and so ordered the world and so designed our world. And moreover, this God is a God who is timeless. He was God before we were born. He is God now that we live. And he is God after we have died. He is a just God. His world reveals his justness. He is a God who has conspired for man to fulfill himself. But obviously in this world, man is frustrated. And obviously in this world, death sometimes is the greatest frustrator. Therefore, is it not reasonable to believe that this just God will fulfill our ambitions and our lives in some future life? Moreover, since this God is just, and since there is an obvious imbalance in this world between goodness and worldly success, is it not right to believe that this imbalance will be righted in some future world, where the good will be rewarded according to their merits, and the evil will be punished according to their wickedness? Such reasoning has led man, philosopher, religionist, and layman, to believe in the possibility of some other life. And we cannot dismiss this reasoning as simply the projection of the life instinct among men. It is much more than that. There is soundness to it, and there is logic to it, and there is reasonableness to it. But of course, it is not conclusive because it lacks proof. But similarly, we lack proof that there is no future life. Both of these positions have to be maintained as matters of mere conjecture, speculation, perhaps no more. One thing, however, we should be clear of, and it is this, that to disbelieve in immortality is not to disbelieve in God, and it is not to be an atheist. Great men, men of great and deep and profound faith, have disbelieved in immortality. Job, for instance. Job, whose faith was the firmest and the finest which man has perhaps ever known, disbelieved in our rebirth. It would have been easy for Job to accept such a position. Indeed, had Job accepted the possibility of personal immortality, his whole life would have been the easier. His whole problem would have been solved. For you recall that Job is tormented by the problem which confronts so many of us. He was being punished. Many misfortunes were occurring to him, and Job was convinced that they were occurring to him through no fault of his own. He had not erred. He had not blasphemed God. He had not sinned against man. He was convinced that he was being unwarrantedly and disproportionately punished in this life. Now, if he had accepted the reasoning of many men of religion and of many philosophers and had believed in some future life, then he could have said, there, in that next life, in that other world, the balance will be righted. There God will reward me for maintaining my faith in him in this life, despite the punishments which have occurred to me. But Job refused to take the easy way out. We read together from the scriptures this morning how he said that though a tree when it dies might be reborn, man when he dies cannot be. He dies and that is the end. And despite his inability to solve this problem which confronts him, how a just God can cause the righteous to suffer, Job maintains his faith, maintains it all the while, refusing to accept the belief in some other life. Indeed, as we read through our Hebrew scriptures, we will find that there are very, very few positive affirmations and assertions of a belief in immortality. It is only with the last centuries of Bible writing, and more especially with the age of the rabbis, of the age of the Talmud, that a belief in personal immortality becomes central to Jewish life. It is then and only then that the prayer, Baruch Atah Adonai Mechaye HaMetim, praised art thou, O Lord, who givest life unto the dead, becomes part of our prayer book. It is then and only then that there is a general consensus of opinion which affirms some future world and our rebirth into that world. It is then and only then that a belief in sechar v'onesh, reward and punishment, heaven and hell, becomes part of the equipment of Jewish thought. But even then, even in those ages in which the Jews believed most completely in some afterlife, they refused to concretize this belief, to harden it, to force it into some definite mold. They refused to say more than we believe. To define the nature of their belief was beyond them. God alone could describe this other world. God alone could describe the type of life into which man will be reborn. God alone could describe the type of punishment which he would make the wicked to suffer. Jewish life refused persistently and consistently to take its eyes from this world and concentrate them on the next. It refused to consider this world as a way station, inadequate, badly heated, filthy, inappropriate, but necessary on the way to final fulfillment in some magnificent palace in heaven. Jewish life refused to consider that it ever controlled the keys to the kingdom. It refused to arrogate to itself the right to say who shall walk in the heavenly streets and who shall be denied entry. This was a matter which God alone could decide. God does not need any group of priests or of ministers or of rabbis to sit down and to say who shall be accepted and who shall be rejected. And certainly, whatever the standards of admission are, they are not mechanical. They are not ritual. They do not have to do with having some holy water or holy word spoken over you. They have to do with how you live, who you are, what use you make of your life here on earth. Tzadikei umot ha'olam yesh lachem chelek lo'olam haba, said the rabbis. The righteous among the nations, all peoples, have a full right to a full share in the world to come. Heaven is not a restricted subdivision into which only those who have accepted a certain faith or worship at a certain temple or utter certain creeds are allowed to enter. Indeed, the very concept of heaven and hell takes in Jewish teaching a quite unique bent and direction. Jewish midrash, Jewish literature, is filled with the rich and fancied imaginations of preachers and teachers and magidim, of storytellers about heaven and hell. But they are all treated with a certain pious irreverence. They are all treated as matters of literary fancy and not a fact. Yes, there is a heaven. Life will be wonderful there. But the rabbis sense that to try to define that life in any terms familiar to us is to make it saccharine and sickeningly sweet. We find the poem of such a man as the teacher Emmanuel of Rome, a teacher of the 13th century, who said, "Hell is a place of evil repute, but at least there'll be gay damsels by my side. In heaven, there's mental stagnation, for there's only old ladies and old men to abide." The rabbis were unwilling to describe heaven, and they were unwilling to people heaven with their friends. Similarly, they were unwilling to describe hell, and unwilling to people hell with their enemies. You can search out Jewish literature and you'll not find a single parallel to Dante. You will not find a single sadistic outpouring of the venom of any man or group of men against all the enemies of our people or against all their personal enemies, relegating them to fiendish tortures. You can search out Jewish tradition and you'll nowhere find any description of the tortures of the netherworld. There is punishment there, but there is no eternal damnation. The worst sinner that the world has ever known will suffer there no more than 11 months. And he'll be allowed to rest, the rabbi said on the Shabbos. And some rabbis suspected that there were earthly tortures which caused man to suffer more than the devil, than Satan could ever devise. One rabbi in the Talmud says that he who suffers from ulcers, he who is poor, and he who has been a prisoner in his life will never have to suffer the agonies of hell. And another rabbi who must have known from his personal experience added, and this is true also of the man who has married a shrewish wife. Again, you sense that this is a matter of fancy, of imagination, not of serious credo belief. Yes, it was edifying to believe in a heaven or hell, but it was equally edifying to see to it that though this was part of the folklore, it was not part of the creed and of the doctrine, and it was never concretized and hardened into a matter of belief. Again, we see this amazing unwillingness of Jewish thought to push belief beyond the bounds of the questions which we can legitimately answer. We can accept immortality on faith, but then we cannot go one step farther and attempt to define this immortality and to refine it according to our own conceptions of what would be just and right. Modern Judaism takes the same course. It also refuses to push human reason beyond its limits. Modern Judaism also refuses to attempt to define and to describe what lies beyond the bourne of time and tide. And perhaps if it differs at all from traditional Judaism, it is that it has overleaped to a sense the teachings and the imaginations and the philosophy of the rabbis and gone back to Job and back to the Bible. We are not quite so sure of the edifying value of even imagining of a heaven and hell. We believe firmly and deeply and fully in God. We believe that life sows its own seeds of immortality among the young people with whom we come in contact, in the bosom of our family, who are never the same for our having been with them and lived with them. There is the immortality of words and of personal worth and of good works. These we emphasize. And perhaps if there is any difference, as I was saying, it is in this, that we refuse to answer the question positively or negatively. We, in a sense, refuse to commit ourselves on which of the horns of this dilemma we will trod. We say simply, we do not know, but this we do know, that God is just. And that since God is just, he will be just with us in whatever lies ahead, as he has been just with us in this life. That God is our Father here, who protects us, and who loves us, and who cares for us. So God will be our Father in the days ranging ahead, loving us, caring for us, protecting us. We approach death much as the patriarch Jacob did. Jacob, when he was dying, asked not for a seat in heaven. He did not ask God to commit himself about his being reborn into his courts. He made no claim on God for his having served God in this life. He said only this, Lishuatcha kiviti Adonai, for thy salvation I await, O Lord. Whatever will be, will be, and I do not fear it. Amen.